Welcome back to PS Editors Podcast. I'm Greg Bruno. Syria's bloody stalemate entered its eighth year on March 15th. Hundreds of thousands have died and millions have been displaced. Solutions have evaded the international community, and as Syria descends deeper into despair, a dangerous proxy war is threatening to pull even more actors in. For the United States in particular, Syria represents a unique failure of vision in global leadership. Half-hearted commitments and red lines rendered meaningless by inaction have eroded America's ability to enforce any lasting truce. And in the vacuum created by Donald Trump's isolationist foreign policy, Syria is spiraling even further out of control. My guest today spent much of his career bringing American diplomacy to some of the world's most intractable crises, from the Balkans to North Korea to Iraq. Today, Ambassador Christopher Hill is a professor at the University of Denver and chief advisor to the Chancellor for Global Engagement. We'll talk to him about what the U.S. and the international community should be doing in the Middle East.
Hello.
Hi, Ambassador. Thanks for joining us today on PS Editors Podcast.
My pleasure.
So lots to talk about, but I'd like to start with Syria, if that's okay, and the imbroglio that the international community finds there. The list of state actors in that conflict is very long and includes Russia, the United States, Turkey, Iran, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and of course Syria, among others. And each of these countries is aligned with non-state actors, and then there are rebel groups and Islamists and mercenaries and ordinary citizens. It's quite the alphabet soup of actors. Just briefly, how did we get here? And who are all of these different competing interests? And what do they want?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely correct that this is a dizzying number of actors. And actors who have played kind of different roles through this whole crisis. So the complexity of this issue seems to sometimes exceed people's patience in trying to understand it. But I think it is well worth going through. And I think it's well worth kind of reflecting on what U.S. interests are. You know, back in 2011, the U.S. first became involved in this by asserting the rights of these opposition groups to come together, free assembly, and to have their freedom of speech. Well, needless to say, this was not something the Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad agreed with. And he immediately began a sort of process of sort of brutalizing this situation, with the consequence that we have a full-blown civil war on our hands. But what we also have are not only, you know, our own interests in seeing freedom of speech and freedom of assembly, but we've seen other countries asserting their own national interests, including Iran, Turkey, and Israel, in fact, and also now Russia. So the situation seemed to be clarifying about a year ago, as Russia began to really intervene heavily to help the regime, as the ISIS issue, ISIS being the sort of second and parallel but related war going on. And so it seemed that ISIS was on the way out. And Assad was busy consolidating power with the helps of Russia and Iran and southern Lebanese group of Hezbollah. But now we're seeing that the situation has once again metastasized into a broader conflict, with Turkey being especially concerned about the Kurds up in the northern part of Syria along the Turkish border, with the issue of ISIS not being quite finished, and ISIS actually sort of melting into some of these other groups in Syria. And so I think we have a situation whose complexity is going to require a U.S. role and as importantly, U.S. understanding of this. And yet we have a Trump administration that really has not been interested in being involved in this. And because of that vacuum, we're seeing a continued effort by other countries.
Yeah, I mean, so let's zero in on the Trump administration approach. And ironically, it's not that different than what the Obama administration was trying to do in terms of looking at the situation in Syria through the lens of terrorism and essentially looking to use reliable proxies to fight ISIS. Now, with that mission somewhat in question as Turkey starts to target Kurdish held positions in northern Syria, and in fact targeting U.S. allies in the north. Does the U.S. have a replacement policy, so to speak, if the Kurds are no longer the reliable allies and proxies that they have long been?
I think the U.S. went into this with a view that on the one hand, you have a hideous authoritarian government under Bashar al-Assad, and on the other hand, you have people who want a more democratic outcome. And that was were groups involved in the Free Syrian Army, except that the Free Syrian Army has turned out to be about 10 Free Syrian armies, and only some of them have been kind of effective in the fight. And the ones who have been most effective in the other war, that is the war against ISIS, have of course been the Kurds. But in being effective with ISIS, they've also had a kind of, in effect, ceasefire with government forces and with Syrian government, meaning that the Syrian government has said to the Kurds that they can have their own autonomy. And the word autonomy in that part of the world is often conflated with essentially independence. And so that's where the Turks just parted company with this. So in the meantime, while the U.S. has always opposed this brutal dictatorship of Assad, it has been difficult to embrace many of these opposition groups who are themselves aligned with some of the most virulent forms of Sunni Arab radicalism coming out of the Arab Peninsula and various Wahhabists. So I think we have wanted to be in total opposition to Assad, but we found that the people to be allied with don't necessarily share our values either.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that there's been a lot of criticism about the United States in its early alignment with the Kurds, not entirely understanding or appreciating what that would mean to Turkish relations and how vehemently opposed the Turks were to an autonomous Kurdish region.
I think the problem has been the U.S. has understood that to support aspirations for Kurdish independence would run us afoul of our NATO ally, Turkey. But at the same time, that NATO ally, Turkey, has not always been easy to deal with in recent years. And the increasing cooperation we've seen between Turkey and Russia, including even the purchase by Turkey of Russian military equipment, has been very problematic within NATO generally and specifically with the U.S. Turkish relationship. The U.S. has tried to make it clear to everybody, including the Kurds, that we stop short of supporting Kurdish independence. But the Kurds have often sort of looked at our support of them, the virtual alliance we've had with them in the fight against ISIS, and sometimes they don't listen so much to the words as they listen to the music. And for them, the music has been that we kind of secretly want to see Kurdish independence. And so it has been difficult to tell them we don't want that, at the same time to maintain this close relationship that we have with the Kurds. Mm.
You know, interestingly, in one of your recent commentaries for Project Syndicate, you suggested that what the U.S. kind of needs to do now is ensure the survival of its various allies on the ground. But if some of those allies are being attacked by a NATO military, how does the U.S. do that? I mean, is that essentially taking on Turkey?
Well, you've got it, because it's extremely complex. And no, I don't think there's any stomach for taking on Turkey. But I think there does need to be a much stronger effort diplomatically to try to harmonize our positions and make sure we're not in open conflict. And here is where I think the Trump administration, in trying to stay out of these quagmires, as they would see them, have not quite understood that sometimes the best way to stay out of a quagmire is to be very engaged diplomatically. And we essentially have a government in Washington that's trying to engage in diplomacy without diplomats. And so I think that is part of the problem, just the capacity of the Tillerson-led State Department to be actively engaged on these issues.
Before we jump into the Trump administration's Middle East policy, I want to dive into something a little, even a little further back, and pose the question as to whether or not Syria is actually a symptom of a much bigger and broader disease, and that disease being the chain reaction of events that was caused after the U.S. invasion in Iraq. Our ability, the United States' ability to deal with the situation in Syria has in many ways been tied to failings in what happened in the Iraq invasion. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
I think there's definitely an element of that. You know, for all the Americans, and there are not very many of them, who think that the intervention in Iraq was a great idea or the intervention in Libya was a great idea, there are many more Americans who question those interventions and question whether we've left the situation better off than when we found it. So I think there's a reluctance in the United States generally, perhaps not so much within Washington among think tanks, but the rest of the country is very skeptical of these things. They don't understand these issues, and they're not sure that the countries involved really share our values. So when the Arab Spring came along, there was a perception that somehow we welcome these developments. And you recall the U.S. was a little slow to pull the rug out from under Hosni Mubarak. And so the view was somehow in Washington, well, we need to show that we understand this sort of these winds of change that have come about. And so I think the U.S. kind of moved perhaps a little too quick to try to pull the rug out from Assad and hope that Assad would fall the way some of these other leaders in North Africa, namely Gaddafi, had fallen. Well, you know, the complexity of Syria going back, you know, depending on when you want to pick up the story, but it's fair to say it's a couple of thousand years. The complexity of that, I think, had us misjudge Assad's stability. And in trying to kind of move against him, he didn't leave. And so I think the U.S. has been frustrated by it. There are many people now who believe we don't understand it. And there are others who say, look, let's just work on ISIS. They're the ones with a global threat. And let's leave the issues of governance in Damascus to the local people involved.
So it was in some ways getting the goal or the objective ahead of the strategy in supporting the removal of Assad, but not necessarily with either the military, the diplomatic and political strategy to get that done.
Or dare I say it's a foreign policy that grows out of American politics, where left-wing Democrats, very concerned about our capacity to spread human rights and democracy to the rest of the world, may have kind of overplayed our hand there. At the same time, many Americans who feel that we are somehow not a good influence on the rest of the world said that we should stay out. So on the one hand, you had this kind of this notion of America as a country that needs to bring democracy to the world, coming in conflict with not one, but two other groups. One, the group I mentioned, that is of isolationists who feel we're too good for the world and should stay away from these kinds of things. But there's also a view expressed by Bernie Sanders and others in the U.S. that in effect we're too bad for the world, and every time we get involved in these things, we leave them worse off than when we started. And so I think the overall consequence is a United States that to some extent has retrenched from some of these global issues.
Right. Yeah. You know, as you're speaking, I'm thinking, well, I can put myself in the Trump administration's shoes and say, well, the U.S. hasn't done nation building very well, so we're not going to do it anymore. And we're going to go back to the old kind of non-committal Middle East policy, where we focus less on stability and more on either targeting terrorists or keeping the oil flowing.
Yeah. Well, I think we've, in the past, we've tended to focus almost entirely on stability, on propping up dictators that were probably not our friends. So I understand the movement away from that. But I think, as is often the case, there seem to be no speed bumps. And so before you know it, we're just looking at oil supplies, as you suggest. And then we've also had this other impulse, as I mentioned, to try to just support democracy. And the absence of democracy in some of these countries, as I've written in Project Syndicate, it's complex. I mean, do not assume that these countries, that you just give them an idea or two and they're off to the races with a democratic constitution. It's going to take a while. And so the complexity of these things, the long-term causes and the long-term remediation of these issues is something that Americans have not had the patience for. And I think it's a big problem as we face an extremely, extraordinarily complex situation in Syria.
Clearly, I think the answer to my rhetorical question is, does Trump have the stomach for it? It's no. But does he have a Middle East strategy at this point, in your opinion?
Well, none that I've been able to see. I mean, to some extent, it's, as you described, an effort to say, let's keep the oil flows going. But I think the problem is, within the Trump administration, there's not enough foreign policy leadership. And so the consequence, and this happens often in American administrations, in the absence of clear, concise leadership, you can have several foreign policies sort of merrily existing side by side. You have people who think we ought to be in there with covert arms programs, and others who say we should not do that, and both think they're reflecting the president's view. So I think we've got a problem in terms of articulating what it is we want there. And I think Secretary Tillerson has tried to address this, but I think his own problems with the president have made him a sort of the people are skeptical that whether he can really speak for the administration. So, there's no question we have a problem. I think we're prepared to go after ISIS, and going after ISIS is what we've done with great success. There's also a view that we are prepared, and I think President Trump demonstrated this, we're prepared to go after Assad when he uses so-called banned weapons, that is, chemical weapons. But beyond that, we don't seem to have any overarching view of this situation. And as we talked earlier, I think Syria is not just a problem of Syria. It's a complexity of the whole region, especially within the Sunni Arab community, and the relationship of that split community to Iran and Iran's interest in projecting its power into the Arab lands.
Yeah, I think that this leads nicely into the next thought or next question that I have. You know, the days of this kind of limited or hands-off approach, when the results of being disengaged from the region didn't really have a wide or meaningful impact, those days are long gone. And it's not just from a humanitarian perspective really anymore. The fact that our regional allies are stronger and more emboldened is clear in the adventurism that Saudis and Emiratis and Turks and Israelis, it's not just the complexity in Syria, but it's the complexity in the region, and the ability for these sovereign states to move independently seems to be exponentially intensifying.
Yes, to understand these states and how they're reacting to change and their own perception of, they're not really sure where the U.S. is, so they're not really sure in making decisions, will this help them with the U.S. or hurt them with the U.S.? So there is a bit of a drift here. And I think the irony is many people in the region, they don't like what the U.S. has to say or has had to say over the years, but they seem to want us to say more. It's akin to the old Woody Allen joke that somehow about a restaurant that the to the effect the food is terrible, and besides, the portions are too small. I think there is this kind of view. They don't like what we're saying, but they think we're not saying enough of it. And this is a challenge for American foreign policymakers. I think it was understandable that President Obama said enough of this Iraq situation, enough of the Afghan situation. We need to focus on other parts of the world. But these situations have, to some extent, metastasized to a broader problem in the Middle East, whose solution I don't think will be possible without much more engaged U.S. leadership.
I mean, there's certainly a desire for U.S. leadership, but what about Arab leadership? Where are the Arabs in all of this, in Syria in particular?
Well, good question, because clearly we have a Saudi Arabia who felt very much estranged from the U.S. because, after all, the U.S. went in and took a Sunni-led country in Iraq, albeit with a Shia majority, and flipped it to being a Shia-led country. And for the Saudis, who have their own problems with their own Shia and who worry a great deal about Iranian influence, in other words, Shia influence, worried that somehow the U.S. unwittingly and rather dumbly had stepped in and created a whole new geopolitical situation for the Saudis, where they look to their northern frontier and they see a lot of Shia there. So clearly a lot of concerns. In comes President Trump, and before you know it, he is essentially bought into everything the Saudis have suggested, even buying into the Saudi feud with Doha. So unclear why the president has done this, but it seems to be related to a view that somehow if we say yes enough to the Saudis, it will help us in finding the elusive peace in between the Israelis and the Palestinians. So these are to go from Obama to or from Bush to Obama to Trump, those are a lot of clutchless shifts in gears. And I think the people in the region have a right to sort of wonder what's going on back there in Washington.
So I want to bring this back in conclusion to your vast experience in the region. And of all that we've talked about, I'm not hearing too many ways forward, but there have to be. And as diplomats and as creative thinkers, people are looking for solutions and will always want to discuss them. So assuming, well, I'm making an assumption here, but assuming that the U.S. can play a role in bringing any sort of meaningful truce to Syria, are there lessons from your past experience that could be applied?
Well, there sure are. First of all, in working on the Balkan solution, which was also a crisis of statehood, crisis of the nation states. In the case of the Balkans, a formation of nation state out of the ashes of what was the Federation of Yugoslavia. The international community got together and worked up something called a contact group plan, which was a sort of effort to define what we felt ought to happen in the future. And then we sold it to the parties. And so you ended up with a situation that most people bought onto it and others rejected it. And so the rejectionists were the ones that you considered the people that you have to convince, either by persuasion or by military force. And so the situation kind of clarified itself. And then we went to a conference in Dayton, Ohio, with all the parties concerned, and we figured out what the map would look like and what the system of governance would look like. I think we need to employ some of those efforts at cooperation among outside powers and see what can be done in Syria. There has been very little success in the U.S. and Russia figuring out a common way forward. We've also talked, I think, excessively about the need for elections in Syria. And, in Bosnia, we left off the elections until much later, because elections without institutions are just a census. If you have elections without institutions, you'll find out how many Kurds there are and how many Sunni Arabs there are, but you won't find out, what kind of politics there can be for the future. So I think the lessons are there to be learned. The trouble is, in this fast-paced world we live in, people often don't spend the time to figure out where we've been before and what lessons we can bring forward. And I think we need to do a lot more of that. I think there needs to be a lot of effort with the European powers, with the Russians, with even the Chinese on these issues, although we've got our hands full with China and dealing with the North Korean question as well.
Well, and the North Korean question was what I wanted to ask you about. Just simply getting people to the table at this point would be a victory in the Syria case. And you had some success getting North Koreans to the table around the six-party talks. Are there parallel lessons for the Syrian crisis using the North Korean model?
I think there might be, but I want to stress that just getting people to the table might become an opportunity for a food fight and not for an effort at kind of descending the ladder of abstraction and figuring out how we can come to common positions on things. So I think before you go to the table, there should be a clear understanding of what it is you're going to the table about, what it is you already agree on, and what are the elements that you don't agree on and require that kind of dialogue across the table. So we had an agreement with the North Koreans. They agreed to give up all their nuclear weapons and return to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. But back in 2009, they disassociated themselves from that prior agreement. So we have to see in the coming weeks and months whether they can be brought back to the idea that we have a concept which was created by multilateral diplomacy known as the September 2005 joint statement, and see if we can get a coalescence around that where the other where North Korea agrees to give up its nuclear weapons and the rest of us agree to live peacefully together with North Korea, to open up trade, to recognize that state, and to otherwise create a lasting peace and stability. And frankly, that's going to take some time.
Well, I think that's a sobering place to leave it, and just a reminder that in the Syrian case, there may not be a table big enough to deal with the negotiations. Thank you so much for your time, Ambassador.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure and a great honor to be able to write for Project Syndicate.
That was Christopher Hill, a professor of the practice in diplomacy at the University of Denver and chief advisor to the Chancellor for Global Engagement. He is also a longtime PS contributor, and you can read all of his columns on our website at www.project-syndicate.com. That's all for this episode. Thanks for listening. Be sure to rate and review our podcast and subscribe on SoundCloud, Stitcher, and iTunes. Until next time, I'm Greg Bruno.